there was a lot of talk in there about hydropower. Let's just jump into the local issues. And there was some conversation about it not being a renewable resource on the federal level. We can get into why not, but I guess I'm more interested in why isn't it yet? What does that fight look like to make that happen or not?
Under the current definition of renewable energy sources in within the Department of Energy, hydropower is not considered renewable. I think part of it is just a historical perspective where incredible dams like the Hoover Dam, Tennessee Valley Authority, Bonneville, huge structures, very permanent in place, literally changed the land. I think people have a tendency to kind of look at that and say, well, that doesn't seem very renewable. Here in Alaska, our hydro resource is different. It looks different. It operates different. It is a much smaller scale. But I think what we've been fighting is just the typical, stereotypical definition of hydropower and what people understand hydro to be. What I've tried to do is convey to colleagues that hydropower as a resource, particularly on smaller scale, whether it's lake tap hydro, run of the river, there is so much that you could define as hydropower. If you can get yourself out of this mindset that it's a big, huge, man-made concrete structure. So that's been our biggest hurdle, is just getting over the image of what policymakers may have in terms of what hydropower is. And so that's why I mentioned in the roundtable how instructive it was to have the Sitka Conservation group come forward with their DVD that they had done about the benefits of small hydro projects. I think we recognize, particularly here in Alaska, we have enormous opportunity to provide power at reasonable rates. But right now, there are obstacles that present themselves because hydro is not on a level playing field when it comes to other renewable energy sources.
You said you distributed that DVD on the Hill. Mm-hmm. Have you had feedback on it?
Well, keep in mind that this was a couple years ago, but that was at the time when we were working on some different energy proposals, and it was more, you know, you're trying to work it staff to staff so that they understand what it is that they're doing. I think that we did raise an awareness. It's been kind of interesting because we're now having some pretty good conversations about some of the different approaches, how you can generate power from irrigation ditches. Now, that's a far cry from the Hoover Dam. But for my colleagues who may be in parts of the country where they don't have significant sources of hydropower because they don't have rushing rivers like we have around here, or incredible amounts coming out of the sky, they can relate to an irrigation ditch, and they can see that, wow, through some pretty small-scale technologies, you're saying that we could provide power to a limited area here? We could provide power to my farm? So we're causing people to look at it differently. And yes, I do think that the local DVD actually helped.
So you had a lot of things cross your proverbial desk in the last couple of hours. What stood out to you? I'm sure a lot of them give you a lot to think about, but what stood out the most to you?
Well, I think partly because I'm so energy centric in my in what I do back in Washington with the time on the Energy Committee, I was listening carefully to see how the people in Sitka view energy. And I think I heard pretty clearly from the Sitka Economic Development Association, from Gary there. He says, you know, if we don't have affordable energy, we're nowhere. We're not going to have any economic development. You heard it from the superintendent of the schools, that when your energy costs go up, you don't necessarily get more money coming to the student. The base allocation per student doesn't go up because your energy costs have gone up. It basically means you've got to pull that money from what you're going to use to educate those kids. When you talk about a quality of life and things that keep families in an area, if it's expensive to live here and they can live in another community for less, they're going to factor that in. I've done a lot of traveling around the state this summer. Spent a lot of time. I've been everywhere from Metlakatla to Kaktovik to Kodiak to the Aleutian Chain, up the Yukon, down the Kuskokwim, and everywhere I'm going, people are talking about energy in varying degrees as far as how it's impacting their families, their businesses, their opportunities. And it's stunning to me to think that in a state that has such an abundance of resource, that our energy costs are the highest in the nation. Fairbanks energy costs is second largest city in the state. They, for cities of comparable size, they are the highest cost city in the country.
That's a paradox.
It is. It absolutely is. So, I mean, energy clearly stuck out to me. What I heard again that I had heard 2 years ago was were comments about how a community really works together, sector to sector, industry to industry, nonprofits to federal agencies. And you might not think that that's anything unusual. I go into a lot of communities where you've got stovepipe situations where I'm working on my stuff. I'm going to fight hard for my state, my federal, my local dollars, and
don't bother me
with your problems. And maybe it's because you're an island community, maybe because you've kind of gone through your economic highs and lows. But there's a greater sense of community here in Sitka than I sense in some of the other communities as I travel around the state, and I think that's to your credit.
Let me ask you this, Senator. Leaving the sequestration crisis, if you will, aside, mm-hmm. say that things get back to normal, so to speak, what do you think the chances are of getting the secure rural schools funding extended?
Well, I'm an optimist, and I'll tell you why I'm an optimist. The chairman of the Finance Committee currently is Max Baucus from Montana. Max and I have had long conversations about secure rural schools because this is important to his state. He is very concerned about how this plays out. My counterpart on the Energy Committee, it's either Ron Wyden or Lisa Murkowski that will be the chairman of the Energy Committee. We have a role when it comes to secure rural schools and the funding. I'm on the Interior Appropriations Committee, as I mentioned. We've got the Forest Service budget. Now, Secure Rural Schools is on. I don't know. It sounds so dramatic to call it life support, but it has been painful going from appropriation year to appropriation year, wondering whether or not these funds are coming to the states, coming then to the individual communities. And as you heard me say, Sitka currently in FY12 got, you know, about $1.2 million. That's substantial. You pull that away, and where does a community like this find those kinds of dollars?
Well, we see, excuse me to interrupt, but we see this this waiting game taking place in our city and our school board budgets right. every year. It's an annual thing.
Because they can't, they don't know whether to count on it.
Exactly. And so they don't. And so there's this big release of pressure when the money has come through these last couple of years. We're not going to have to lay off this many teachers. We're not going to have to shorten the school day or, you know, do dramatic things.
But you, you hate to have to govern by default.
Of course.
And to a certain extent, that's kind of what is happening there. We're not giving the certainty to the communities that they need. We're not giving the certainty to the districts to be able to budget. And so everybody's shortchanged. Everyone's just a little bit stressed. Is there some way that we can't provide for a better path? So what I was working on with Senator Baucus and with Senator Wyden, and again, keep in mind, Oregon gets the lion's share of Secure Rural Schools funding. So Senator Wyden has a very, very keen interest in this. We actually have a Secure Rural Schools caucus where we, those senators that are impacted, whose states are impacted, we sit down, we talk about, okay, is there something that we can put together? The proposal that that we had hoped to be able to move forward would have put things on a glide path towards a reduced number, but a number that you could at least count on instead of this kind of up and down and is it going to be here or not. We weren't successful with that because we simply couldn't find that much of a pay for, and that was Senator Baucus's concern. But what he has done is he has pledged to work with me. Senator Wyden has also said we've got to resolve this. So that's why I'm optimistic, because I think you've got a bipartisan group of individuals that, quite honestly, are in some pretty key committee spots. So it's never going to be easy, but I do think it's doable.
The gridlock in Congress, obviously now the blame has shifted toward there's an election coming up, and it's certainly gone on longer than that. What do you attribute that to, and what have been some of the specific frustrations for you in dealing with this process?
Well, you know, I'm not one who really spends a lot of time trying to assign blame. It's not productive. What is more productive in my mind is, okay, how do we get out of this mess? I'll tell you, I can't wait to get on the other side of this election, because the president is blaming the Bush administration, the Republicans are blaming Obama. The fact of the matter is we're in a mess right now. We've got debt that is not sustainable. The Senate has not passed a budget now in over 3 years. We have not been able to figure out how we fix the post office. We haven't been able to deal with disasters that have come our way. We haven't been doing our job. And so the easier thing for me to do would be to blame Harry Reid or blame President Obama or blame, you know, my colleagues. It's a mess. Let's figure out how we're going to get around it. But by assigning the blame, then the other side just gets mad because, you know, now I'm ticked off because you're pointing the finger at me, and so I'm not going to cooperate with you. We've got to get on the other side of this. I think part of what we're dealing with is just a division where we elected individuals have been pulled to both sides of the political spectrum. Those on the left, those on the right, who feel that, you know, we've got to answer to our base. Awful lot of people in the middle. Who's answering to that base?
Okay, so it sounds like what you're kind of working for is once we get past this section, sort of the no regrets, let's just work with what we have and work together and get back to where we need to be sort of policy. Do you think that's the attitude of your colleagues?
I hope so. I'm not waiting until after the election. I'm working on some things right now that I want to move on. I'm working with Ron Wyden on how we can roll out an energy policy. I'm trying to figure out how we deal with this horrible issue that we're facing. We've got millions and millions and millions of dollars that are being spent on campaigns, and who's benefiting from them? I mean, do you think that you're getting the information that you want out of the candidates? We're putting money down a rat hole, and what do we have to show for it? So is there some way that we can put in place some meaningful disclosure that will maybe put some check on where we are right now? And I'm working on that with several different Democrat colleagues. I guess I can do that because I'm not running for election. Those that are running for election are busy trying to get elected. But, you know, I think that's part of our problem. We're all spending time trying to get elected, raising money so that we can get to the next election, worried about what this amendment is going to mean on my record. Is that going to impact my election? You know, we're spending way too much time focused on that and not enough time in governing.
Speaking of amendments, would you support a constitutional amendment to state that corporations are not persons for purposes of the First Amendment?
You know, there's Senator Durbin is actually looking at that. We've been trying to figure out how we can deal with this Citizens United. And because of the Supreme Court case, there are many who believe that the only way that we can adequately address it is through a constitutional amendment. That may be the case. I'm looking at some other alternatives because, quite honestly, getting the two-thirds vote necessary for a constitutional amendment is just darn hard. When was the last time we got a constitutional amendment through? And so I'm not convinced that we can do it that way. So if there's another way to do it, that's what I'm looking for.
I don't think this is, I'll just toss this out, I don't think this is as controversial as ERA, which failed.
ERA is still, you realize that's still in process, like 27 years later? It's stunning to me.
The timeline hasn't lapsed then, huh?
No. And I asked about that. I said, does the clock ever stop ticking? And I guess as long as states are still willing to take it up.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
But
it
could take 5 years to convert everything to digital. But
my impression is that if Republicans, Democrats generally seem to agree in all parts of the country that something must be done about Citizens United.
I think so.
May I ask, did the Citizens United decision have an impact on your last campaign? I mean, were you able to raise more money or spend more money?
I wasn't able to raise or spend more money. As a candidate, I'm still covered by the campaign laws and the disclosure that is out there, and I'm totally good with that. If you give me $251, I have to disclose that. If you give me $249, you don't have to disclose it. That's just the way the federal rules are. And I'm totally fine with that. But what Citizens United allowed for was you could give money, you could give $25,000 if you wanted to a group, a 529, a group that was designed to help support me without any disclosure. I don't think that's right.
And so during this, I guess I'm just trying to find out, during this last race,
was that a factor?
Were you a benefactor?
Sure was.
Okay.
And I can say that my campaign was probably one of the first beneficiaries, if you will, of Citizens United, where you can take, I called it a 529, it's 527, where you can allow for that kind of an unlimited donation with very limited disclosure, and I was the beneficiary. So you would think that, well, okay, I need to protect it because you never can tell when I'm going to need it again. But here's the rub here. It just doesn't seem right that as long as you're giving it to me, the candidate, you're subject to this full disclosure. But that you should be able to give it to a group who was formed to really help influence my election. And because it's not directly to me, that somehow or other you can hide behind that smoke It just doesn't seem right. It just doesn't seem right. So what we're dealing with, there were a couple different attempts to change the disclosure requirements, and they did not receive the requisite support to proceed, and the case be known that it was a politically motivated. It allowed for an uneven playing field. It was going to require disclosure by some groups, but not disclosure by the other. Now that to me doesn't make sense. If we're going to require disclosure, I don't care what group you're with. I don't care what your last name starts with. It ought to be even, and it ought to be simple. And so that's exactly what we're trying to build, is something that's even and something that's simple and something that just is common sense.
And meets constitutional muster.
And meets constitutional muster.
Just if we can stay in the vein of electoral politics, mm-hmm. let's go back to 2010. The last time you were here, we had talked a little bit about how you would be received by the GOP caucus, mm-hmm. given mm-hmm. the nature of the campaign and everything. How has the term gone in that regard? Obviously, you caucus with the Republicans, but mm-hmm. do you feel freer now to do things than?
Well, I let's put it this way. I guess I've been one that is not afraid to speak my mind and do what I feel is right. I think that the reception that I received when I went back to the Senate was just fine. Everybody loves a winner. I had some folks that perhaps felt a little bit awkward because it was no secret that they had worked against me and they were people in my own party, and now I'm back.
So how does that kind of, I mean, do they show up at your, hi, Lisa, how you doing? I mean, what happens?
You know, everybody's a grown-up back there, and some were just direct and said, gosh, boy, did I call that one wrong. And then you move on. Because once you've got that election certificate, it doesn't make any difference whether you won by, 30 points or whether you won by 30 votes. You are there as the elected representative for your state. And, I know for some, they are, they think that I am perhaps a little too independent. And that's fine if they think that, because quite honestly, that's the way Alaskans are. And it was Alaskans that put me back there, not the Republicans in my caucus. So it is somewhat freeing that way.
With that perspective and getting past 2010, and now we've had this period of moving closer to 2012, how do you feel about your party as it stands right now? Because it's sort of been a party in transition in these mm-hmm. last few years. And mm-hmm. May continue to be, it may settle here after November. How do you feel about your party?
Well, I tell you, I want my party to be a vibrant party. I want my party to be representative of the country. I don't want it to be made up of primarily white people in the South. I want there to be women from the Northeast and Hispanics from the West Coast. I want to make sure that we are a dynamic party. And I probably might make some people uncomfortable, but I think we need to make sure that we are viewed as that dynamic party, that we are a party that equally embraces people of all demographics, people of all ethnicity, people of gender. And sometimes I'm concerned that we are not viewed as inclusive as we would like to be known. And so that's important for us.
How do you think Governor Romney's 47% remark?
I don't think that helped us. I think that it has perhaps been misconstrued or, I don't know that you can say, taken out of context, because the press has been very careful to make sure that the full text is there. But you know, I don't think it was intended to suggest that those who receive any form of, whether it's assistance or support from the federal government, that somehow or other they are they're somehow less. And by that I mean, you know, you look at, just take the Alaskan example, where we have so many federal workers. Are those people that you know, are somehow or other not carrying their weight? I don't think so. I talked to the people in the Park Service and the Forest Service and the federal employees that I meet and that I work with. I certainly don't think he was suggesting that our veterans, who all receive some form of federal assistance, whether it's their health care or education. I don't think he was referring to Alaska Native people, who through IHS and BIA, you know, that's a trust obligation. But that's a federal payment. That's probably calculated as part of that number, 47%. So I think it's a reminder to us that words matter, and I think by the comment that he made, there were people that were offended because they are recipients. Those that receive Social Security, that paid into that system, I don't think that they feel that they're getting something that they didn't contribute to.